I'm in Steve Goldman. How you doing, bud?
Great to be back here, as always. You know, a nice nice little three-week hiatus.
Yep.
Squeezed in the Northern Trust in my travels. But yeah, good to be back on Long Island's only golf talk radio show.
And what do you got for us in the news and notes?
Well, I think I want to just get this out of the way so this way we could be in a better frame of mind.
I mean,
you know, we've talked about the FedEx Cup a lot, and, you know, obviously we have our problems with it, but, I mean, what they're trying to do here to try to solve, to quote unquote solve the problem that the winner of the Tour Championship also wins the FedEx Cup. I mean, they might be fooling the casual golf fan, but anybody who actually like pays attention, even remotely pays attention, I mean, they're not getting fooled by this. So I managed to crunch some numbers to try to figure out who's actually winning the Tour Championship, as opposed to who they say is winning the Tour Championship.
Yeah.
So right now we've got a three-way tie at the top of the leaderboard. You got Rory McIlroy, Xander Schauffele, and Paul Casey. They're all 7-under par stroke-wise, but vastly different FedEx Cup-wise. None of them are leading the FedEx Cup, are leading the quote-unquote Tour Championship right now.
Right.
That would be Brooks Koepka, who's one back of those three, but he's actually leading by a stroke, if you can try to follow that. Right. You try to follow along with that.
Right.
So McIlroy is one back, Schauffele's two back, and Casey's four back, even though they're all tied for first.
Gotcha.
Got it.
I'm on.
Okay? You're on that?
I'm on that.
All right. Ches Reavy, he's two back, but he's really seven back.
Gotcha.
How about that?
Gotcha.
So how does it feel like... You know, normally you go to the Tour Championship, it's, you know, the culmination of the season, there's a big paycheck involved, maybe the FedEx Cup also involved now that they threw in the FedEx Cup here.
Sure.
And you're Ches Reavy and you're two shots off the lead and they say, no, you're seven off the lead. So now you've got to make up seven shots even though you're only two behind. And two behind, none of the players that are in first.
I just, the end in this case, and people will argue that it's a decent leaderboard. I mean, Brooks Koepka, Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy,
sure.
Those three alone.
Yeah, why
awesome.
Not?
Beautiful. Love it. But let's not kid ourselves. This is not how it should be.
But to pretend that somebody on Sunday is going to hoist the trophy and say they're the winner of the Tour Championship when they may not have had the fewest number of strokes,
right,
still doesn't solve their problem.
No.
They could say all they want, okay, here's the winner of the Tour Championship, here's your FedEx Cup, congratulations, you take two trophies home. But it's still, for me, as a golf fan, would leave a bad taste in my mouth saying that person didn't have the fewest number of strokes, so why is he holding up a trophy?
Well, the fact that you're calling it the Tour Championship is problematic.
Right.
Because that's not the winner.
No.
The winner is the FedEx Cup champion. So just call it the FedEx Cup.
Right.
The FedEx Cup tournament presented by Coca-Cola.
Right.
Or whatever you're going to call it. But don't call it the Tour Championship because the winner isn't the winner of the Tour Championship.
Right. And or if you just want to solve the problem, then just have the top 30 people who qualify and just say, look, winner take all. We're playing one tournament, winner take all.
Yeah.
Whoever literally wins the Tour Championship, fine. We'll give them the FedEx Cup also. And you say that's not fair because of what they did all season. Well, there's nothing fair about this either because, like we said, It's to me, it would be a hollow victory. I mean, I'm not telling these people how to feel, but to me, if I'm holding up a trophy that says I won a tournament, even though I didn't have the fewest number of strokes, I don't know how I would feel about that.
Yeah. I mean, I would feel happy with the $15 million.
Of
but
course.
But I hear what you're saying.
And if I win the FedEx Cup without winning the Tour Championship, am I going to feel terrible about that? Of course not, because the FedEx Cup is that year long aggregate. Now, granted, they do place the emphasis on, you know, the playoff events where mm-hmm. they get more points and everything, but still, winning the FedEx Cup is winning the FedEx Cup because it shows that you've had a really consistent, very good season, and the fact that you don't win the ending tournament or the last tournament of the season, to me, I mean, who cares? I mean, yeah, it might be a bad, they might be conceiving this as a bad optic by saying, okay, like last year, you know, Justin Rose, you know, got up and down on 18 to win the FedEx Cup, even though they still played out the Tour Championship. So it was anticlimactic, but so what?
Right.
At least it's fair.
Right. It is what it is. I mean,
right.
I'd rather live in those two worlds than to deal with this.
Right. Whatever. All right. Whatever. So we got that out
let's
of the
get
way.
To the, let's get to the real tournament, which is the Met Open.
Let's get to the Met Open, of course, the 104th, the 104th Met Open at Piping Rock, which concluded on Thursday. Always a great event. And, of course, friend of the show, Matt Dobbins, shooting 66 on Thursday, a bogey-free 66 to beat Michael Grabois by two strokes. Of course, Matt Dobbins from the Meadowbrook Club, Mike Grabois from Watchung Valley, which I believe is in New Jersey. And, of course, Ben Polland, I guess the Newman to Matt Dobbins Seinfeld.
Exactly.
Ben Polland from Deepdale. Unfortunately, he fired an opening round 63 and backed it up with a 67, but unfortunately shot 73 on Thursday. So he actually finished in third, three shots back. And friends of the show, Andrew Sobota, Mike Ballow Jr., both finished tied for eighth at minus six. Jason Karen and Mark Brown finishing tied for 17th at minus three. And you got to give a shout out, 66-year-old George Zahringer. He didn't make the three-round cut, but shooting 70 and 76 and missing the cut by three strokes. You know, not bad for us. You know, I hope if I'm 66 someday, I mean, obviously I'm not going to get to be as good as George Zahringer at whatever right. I get to do. But to be even remotely that close to be able to be that competitive at 66.
Yeah. Amazing.
That would be pretty impressive.
I'll sign up for that now. If I can.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, the Walker Cup team was announced at the conclusion of the U.S. Amateur on Sunday. And, of course, for my money, the U.S. Amateur, to me, it's not even close. The U.S. Amateur is the hardest golf tournament to win without question.
100%.
The fact that you have 312 players that qualify for stroke play and only 64 qualify for match play, and it's a hard 64. So in this particular event, they had 27 players playing for three spots in a playoff, which is ridiculous on its own.
Yep.
And the players that actually got through the playoff actually made it through and had deep runs in the match play event. So it's bad enough that you have to play two rounds, one on different golf courses. So you get one shot on each golf course just to make it to the top 64, which basically, let's just say for the math people out there, that's 20% of the field.
Yep.
There's no tournament out there where you need to be in the top 20% to qualify,
right,
to make a cut.
Yep.
I mean, even a U.S. Open, 60 out of 156 is a pretty tough cut.
Right, exactly.
But this is an impossible cut to make.
Yeah.
And then, congratulations, now you got to play six rounds of match play.
Exactly.
Including a 36-hole match on Sunday.
I mean,
to win that tournament, to me, I don't see how you can argue that there's another tournament out there that's harder to win than that one.
No, hands down, most grueling.
And the fact that now with their system, the winner of the U.S. Amateur gets an automatic bid, automatic qualifier onto the Walker Cup team, which I think is completely deserving. That's Andy Ogletree. He's from Georgia Tech. He defeated John Augenstein from Vanderbilt. And John Augenstein always comes to mind because he actually participated in the purchase qualifier for the U.S. Open, and he missed the playoff by one shot.
Yep.
As an amateur, and he's going to be a senior at Vanderbilt. And, of course, a couple other notable people. We already talked about before, but, of course, bearing mention, Stuart Hagestad, friend of the show, 28-year-old Stuart Hagestad, the number one ranked mid-am in the world. Of course, he got an automatic qualifying bid based on his standing in the amateur rankings. And selections by Captain Nathaniel Crosby, John Pack from Scotch Plains, New Jersey. He's a junior at Florida State. And Brandon Wu from Scarsdale, New York. He's part of that Stanford contingent that he graduated. He was actually the medalist at the USM. And again, telling you how tough it is to win this tournament, he's the medalist at USM. He got bounced in the first round of match play.
Yep.
And of course, he and his buddy Isaiah Salinda, also from Stanford, also a graduate, NCAA national champion, Stanford golf team. And of course, Isaiah Salinda will be teammates with Cole Hammer, and Isaiah Salinda beat Cole Hammer in the NCAAs in order to win the national championship. So it'll be a nice, interesting rivalry for them. So,
yep.
So we're looking forward. Unfortunately, it's going to be in England. So it's going to be some early mornings, September 7th and 8th. But definitely looking forward to the Walker Cup matches this year.
Yeah, it's going to be, and I hope they air them. I don't know if they're going to be on tape delay or whatever, but I hope they cover them as much as they, you know, they've covered them in the past.
It would be nice because, you know, we've seen plenty of people that go from the Walker Cup go to start, not just to the PGA Tour, but to stardom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we've already seen two players that should be on this team, but they decided to turn pro. And look what happened. You had Colin Morikawa.
Yep.
And you had Matthew Wolf,
yep,
who easily would have been on this Walker Cup team. But instead, oh, by the way, let's just go win a PGA Tour event. Right. And let's be exempt for the next 2 years on the PGA Tour instead of playing on the Walker Cup team.
Well, I don't know what you were doing at 22, but I wasn't winning the PGA tournament. I'll tell you that.
I can tell you, I did not have my life. I did not have my life figured out at 22. I'll tell you that much.
Oh my God, unbelievable! All right, well, thank you, Steve, for the news and notes. I'm looking forward to talking with Tim Riley, social media manager for golf.com. It's going to be a fun show. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit petesgolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
All right, we're back. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony. He's Steve. And on the line is social media manager for golf.com, Tim Riley. Tim, how you doing this morning?
Good morning, guys. How are you today? I'm doing well.
Doing great. Let's start with you being the social media manager. Tell us a little bit about your capacity, what you do, and how you do it.
Sure. I mean, I joined the golf team about 2 years ago now. So I oversee all of our social platforms between Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Do the day-to-day kind of work there. So if you follow any of the golf accounts, I would be the man behind the scenes. If you were to put a face to it or name to it, that would be me, the one pushing out that content on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I contribute as a writer between .com and Golf Magazine itself as well. So you'll see the occasional byline from me as well mixed in there.
How do you, how do you organize the different content, or how much different is the content between the different channels? They all, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, they're obviously very similar, but all in some cases very different. How do you, when you aggregate your content, how do you decide which is going to go be pushed out on what platforms?
Yeah, they're actually very different, surprisingly. So it's, you know, Twitter, you kind of think about how you use each platform.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter's kind of used as an in-the-moment news, kind of what's happening every minute on tour. What was that shot? What was this shot? What's going on every second of the day? Facebook's more used for, you know, longer reads and people, like, getting headlines. It's more, like, headline-based than reads. And Instagram's more, like, visually pleasing. You know, it's about the photos, about the videos, how things look, how can we stimulate you from visually pleasing kind of content on that side there. So everything's kind of tailored specifically for each platform. So it takes some time. It's not, you can't just throw the same thing up the same three ways in all three. So you can take one story and it's going to look completely different and teased out differently on all three platforms.
Do you, when you're planning your content, how much of it do you take into account? Because a lot of this stuff is happening obviously in real time. But then there's also the planned stuff. How did you manage the real time with the planned stuff? And do they, you know, it's almost like, do they conflict with each other, or how do you process that and manage it?
A little bit. Yeah, sure. So, you know, we're always looking ahead, seeing what's on the tour schedule, what's coming up that week, but not only that week, what's coming up, you know, 4 weeks from now. So we can start kind of planning ahead what we want to go out on certain days and what makes sense for those days. And, you know, we do cover the tour, but we cover much more than the tour. So we do a lot of golf lifestyle, and we're big on instruction content. So it's kind of a mix and match on what people want to see on what days. Like, we understand that instruction is what people want to read on the Thursday, pretty much Thursday leading into the weekend. The Thursday, Friday is a big push. The Saturday, Sunday mornings before people get out on their games. And then Monday, Tuesdays when people are kind of recovering from what they did over the weekend, you see a lot more instruction content from us based pushed out on the social channels, because that's what people want to read. Like, you know, they more than what happened on the tour that weekend, they want to help their own games out.
Sure.
So it's a balance of mixing in, you know, if it's a big tournament, you know, if it's one of the majors, that tournament coverage, the tour coverage is going to be king for us. But outside of that, we kind of tailored around what we know that people are trying to read. You know, we could look at past history, what's going on, what people are clicking on, what they weren't. And it's a surprising mix. Like I said, people are always interested in the tour events for sure, but I think people are surprised how much they really care about their own games more than Brooks Koepka's.
Our guest is Tim Riley, Golf Magazine social media editor. Tim, the editorial process, obviously very different with social media as opposed with either print media or the online media. I'm curious to know what challenges you face when trying to determine, you know, what content to put out or what content needs, you know, you look at it and you say, well, maybe we should tweak this a little bit, or maybe we're not saying it the right way. And also obviously getting your voice out there and, you know, wanting to be heard and wanting to be read.
Yeah. You know, sometimes, you know, we have some of these fantastic writers, the senior writers, especially people like Alan Shipnook and Michael Bamberg is on the chair, and they'll write these beautiful 5,000 word pieces and you only have 280 characters to sum it up. So sometimes you just don't do it justice, and you read it, you're like, oh, this is masterful here, and then it's like I'm summing it up in a short anecdote, trying to click on it, you're like, oh, this just doesn't feel right, cutting the piece that beautiful into such a short little headline here, you know, one or two sentences there. So that's probably the most challenging part I face, kind of trying to do them justice for what the work they put in, those guys. And the magazine, sometimes it's just hard because some of the mag pieces aren't kind of written for the digital world, so it's a case of trying to convert it. You know, it's a different audience. You know, our social audience is much younger than a magazine audience. Some of the pieces for there that are more relevant for that audience just might not work on social. And, you know, it's hard to swallow the pill and not put that out on social, but you just have to take into account that they are two completely different audiences at the end of the day.
How much do you enjoy being on the other end of it, being able to push out your own content? That's got to be kind of a fun thing, because you're talking about writing, you know, putting out stuff and making a headline for some other people, but it's kind of cool to be able to push out stuff that you're doing yourself.
It is, but it feels a little self-serving. I would feel a little guilty. I'm like, I don't want to throw like my own handles or, you know, share my own stuff too often there.
Right.
You know, that's kind of, yeah, I don't like being that self-serving, but it's a weird feeling, especially when I'm on my personal handles and I'm scrolling through the golf handles, like, oh, yeah, I'm looking at a feed, a post that I pushed out on my post. That's always a weird little world.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about being a major component of your audience being interested in the instructional content, and you and I got to play with Luke Kerr-Dineen, and what proportion, you know, who's sort of in charge of all that stuff, how much were you surprised that is really what people are interested in above all? Like, I would say probably disproportionately people are interested in instruction more than anything else.
Yeah, they are. That really threw me for a loop when I first started here.
Yeah.
I was a reader for a while, and on the outside looking in, I was always just like, all right, this is a tour coverage company. This is what they do. This is all they focus on. That's what people know golf, you know, golf for. That they follow Golf Magazine and Golf.com social accounts because they want to know what's going on with Tiger and Brooks and Rory. And then as I got there and you start seeing the metrics and, you know, the feedback coming in, and it was kind of astonishing just how much people were reading instruction and, you know, and the times it was popping. That was kind of funny for me, just realizing, you know, the Monday morning pops on instruction. I'm like, this is all about, you know, so-and-so. I struggled with my slice this weekend. Now I'm searching this, or struggle, whatever it was I'm struggling with, and seeing those pop on Monday, that's really what they wanted to read, along with the tour. Don't get me wrong. Tour is still king, the tour news. But the instruction, yes, the correlation to how much people read that is kind of startling at times. And, you know, it's so much so that recently, Luke, you mentioned Luke there. Luke does a fantastic job. He revamped all of our instruction content over the last year. It's night and day what he's done with our digital front, especially in the social space. But we saw such a push where we had people sending us their swings. I mean, that was the biggest thing for me. I would check our messages, our DMs, and they'd be flooded with people sending us our swings, and they'd be like, you know, please fix my swing, what am I doing wrong? That Luke and I sat down, and we actually started a Facebook group a couple months ago called How to Hit Every Shot. So it's a golf Facebook group there, and we have golf top of the earth teachers, and they will give you free advice. I mean, you drop in that group. It's a very, very engaged group. There's like 6,000 members now in only 2 months.
Wow.
And every day, people are dropping in their swings and helping each other out. This worked for me. That didn't work for me. And then on top of that, you get a handful of our top notch teachers and Luke himself. He chimes in, and they give you free pointers. I mean, it's a fantastic little thing going on, we see.
That's awesome. We got to take a short break, but more with Tim Riley from Golf.com, Golf Magazine. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
At Winfield United, we understand the challenges you face and the goals you have. We promise to do our best and to help you do yours.
With the introduction of tools like the Geotech Insight platform and products like Droplex Extra, we are advancing the industry to new levels, allowing you to manage your time and budget more efficiently. Visit WinfieldUnitedPro.com to find a representative near you today. Winfield United, a proud sponsor of the Long Island Golf Course Superintendents Association.
Owning the latest and greatest golf equipment makes no difference if it's not fit perfectly for your game. At Mizuno, we create irons and woods for all skill level golfers, from our MP18 family featuring three different models designed for the better player to our JPX family featuring three different models designed to give you distance and forgiveness. We have a model for everybody. Visit Pete's Golf Shop and get custom fit for a set of Mizunos today.
We're back. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony. He's Steve. And on the line is the social media manager, Tim Riley for golf.com. Tim, we got a chance to play yesterday, you and I and Luke, my formidable partner there, at yesterday's match. But we got to play Bethpage Red, which you wrote an article on, ironically, that we happen to be just playing it randomly together, and you recently wrote an article about it. Talk a little bit about growing up on Long Island and just how much you've enjoyed playing golf on Long Island.
Yes, so I grew up in Babylon, so 20 minutes outside of Bethpage. So Bethpage was always kind of one of my backyard courses to go there, play, you know, one of the five courses, and mostly not black. Black is a little above my caliber, as much as I love it. But, yeah, the red piece you read there, I wrote that right around the PGA, you know, because a lot of my coworkers, you know, were black is all you hear about all week leading up to it, this and that. And none of my coworkers are from Long Island except for me. So I was kind of breaking it down for them, like, you know, what the red is really like for the locals and how that's, you know, for guys like me, the average golfer, that's the more fun, enjoyable course. It's the perfect mix of challenging and fun all in one, and that anyone can play it. You know, the better players or the guys learning the game, everyone enjoys that course. So that's why, for me, that's always my favorite of the five courses at Bethpage Black there. I mean, on Bethpage Park. But as a whole, Long Island, we're just so spoiled. I mean, everywhere we go, it's remarkable for such a small piece of property how many top courses are here. It's really startling, especially when I go over stuff like we're talking the social space and we're teasing stuff out. I go over the top 100 courses list, which is a big thing for us to make one of those top 100 courses. And it's so top-heavy for New York and Long Island alone. I think there's like 10 or 12 from Long Island. It's crazy just to be that considered that highly, the golf in this small of a neighborhood here. And especially growing up in, like I said, I grew up in Babylon. I know we talked yesterday in a round playing Swamp Bombs. So I had this beautiful par 3 course opened up when I was 10, 11, 12, somewhere in that area there. So it was right around the time that I was just swinging a golf club for the first time. So that couldn't have come at a better time for me to learn the game. And if anyone's looking to learn how to play golf, I highly recommend that par 3 course. It is perfect for that. And if you're
we love the sumps.
We love the sumps.
Yeah, it is. It is the perfect place to pick up your wedge and just work on those clubs that you don't want to practice, but you should be practicing. It is ideal for that. But yeah, I mean, now I live in the city now, but I mean, every weekend in the summer and fall, I mean, I try to get home as much as I can just to get back to Long Island and play golf. That's really what I'm trying to. I can't play in the city, and I want to be on Long Island and play, so that's pretty much what I'm doing is every weekend I can, as it worked out yesterday, playing with you at a random coincidence there at Bethpage Red. It's beautiful, though.
Yeah, it was great. What I liked, what you captured about the article, was that really, you know, the red course is, it's sort of like there's Bethpage Black, and this is the red would be almost like Bethpage Black Light. It has everything that you want from the black, a great layout, you know, a beautiful routing, a beautiful mix of a very strong routing in terms of variety and in par threes and par fours, good par fives. It's everything you want that you get really from the black, minus some, you know, obviously the rough and some of the grueling nature of it. But it has, you know, all the sort of principles that you would get in the black, but just in a much more manageable, consumable, enjoyable walk, as opposed to the black, which can be very draining.
Yeah, it's just fun. Like I said, I think it's just such a great layout. They do such a good job there. I know usually the greens are pristine as well. You know, it's just a wonderful course. I really can't say enough good things about it there. I think people get intimidated by the black, and you can have a good time while still getting challenged on the red. That's all you could ask for.
I don't know of anybody who's ever played the red, myself included, that walked off that golf course and said, I wish I played the black instead. Because to me, the red is every bit as challenging, especially for the high handicapper. You know, yes, playing the black is an experience, and everybody should have the experience to do that. But to me, there's no the red does not take a backseat to anybody.
No, it definitely doesn't.
And it shouldn't.
You know, and it kind of. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I said it shouldn't. It shouldn't take a backseat to anybody either.
No, not at all. And for me, it's right there on par, not far either below or with it, with Montauk Downs. I think the two of those courses are really as good as it gets with public courses there. They remind me a lot of each other.
So speaking of articles that you've written, one of your latest articles was a retrospective of a round you played 2 months ago because, of course, the U.S. Open coming back to the area, coming to Wingfoot. Wingfoot has a special place in my heart because it's kind of where I got my start in doing volunteering, the 2004 U.S. Amateur, which Ryan Moore won, and then back 2 years later volunteering at the U.S. Open, and, of course, being on 18 fairway as Phil Mickelson whizzing his drive right over my head, of course. Being a big Phil guy as you are, one of the more deflating moments in my sort of sports career was watching the meltdown and watching it happen right in front of me, trying everything I could to give him some different mental vibe than what he was doing. And we're all trying to sit there, try to get him, just punch out in the fairway. Par wins, bogey ties. And and we just couldn't figure out a way to get him to not try to hit that second shot over those trees. But he tried it anyway. And, look, it's 13 years later and I still can't get over it.
I know. It's typical Phil, though. Phil's always going to go for it. But, yeah, it's just even thinking about that, that's hard to talk about right now. But, yeah, my first time at Wingfoot, that was all I thought about on 18. I got the tee box. And this moment I stepped there, I'm like, man, I can't believe Phil messed this up. just hit an iron, Phil,
But even making a mistake with driver, that's fine. But then compounding the mistake, trying to somehow get on the green in two when he really didn't need to do it. Because the funny thing is, from my selfish perspective, is we're standing on the fairway at 18 and Colin Montgomery seems like he's taking forever to wait to hit his second shot. And of course, he flubs it and we can't see the green. So we couldn't figure out what was going on. And all of a sudden, Mike Lupica, the sports writer, he walks right past us and he's telling everybody, Montgomery double bogeyed. So everybody suddenly just gets charged up. And that's when we all sort of said, okay, fine. Then chip out. Go ahead, Phil. Chip out in the fairway. Go ahead, make par from the fairway. It's right there for you. Go ahead.
That's
do it.
Just Phil.
Yeah.
Phil doesn't just lose. He goes turning down. It's all or nothing.
That's true.
With Phil.
But just to get back to your experience from a couple of months ago, even though we only have about a minute, basically the vibe I got from your article is this golf course is ready for the U.S. Open right now.
I mean, you could have played it the day I was there. I mean, it's just always ready for the host any kind of dig at the moment. It's crazy how well kept that place is. It's just an immaculate piece of property. The property's crazy, and just inside you feel like it is stuck in time and nothing has changed, and for the better. Nothing has changed for the better the way you don't want it to change inside. It's just a fantastic place. The clubhouse, the course, everything about it just surpasses every expectation you could have for it.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time this morning. It was a blast to meet you. As we get older, the world gets smaller, and to be able to, ironic that you are the social media manager and we get a chance meeting on social media. Look forward to talking with you again in the near future.
Yeah, that is one of the best parts of social media. We got to run back our match. I owe you and Luke a little payback.
Exactly. That was a good match. It was fun and you played awesome. You drove the ball really well and I thought we were in trouble early on, that's for sure.
Yeah, Luke got my head on 18 there. I knew I was scoring well, and it all came undone on 18. But it was a great time. Hey, thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you having
me on. Thanks, Tim.
All right, our guest was Tim Riley, social media manager for Golf.com, Golf Magazine. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorch, folks. We'll catch you back, same bat channel, next week.
This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DF FM 95.9 Freeport.